Good evening. This is tape number one for Humanities 294, Native American Religion. And I guess to start off with this first tape, for those of you who are new students and haven't had the dubious honor of having a course with me before, I'll give a little introduction here to myself to start off with. I've been up here in Alaska for about 15 years now, including some time outside when I was doing graduate work. I got my undergraduate degree in sociology and anthropology from the University of Alaska some time ago, probably when most of you were just kids. I spent a couple years outside in Japan doing some undergraduate work, and some years ago I went back to Arizona and got a graduate degree in Japanese studies. Language, culture, sociology. And later I came back and I worked at the university and for AFN for a year or so out in the Fairbanks in the Northwest area. And then I returned to graduate school and I got another graduate degree in Indian education programs. And I came back up here out of graduate school about 3 years ago and got hired by the student program. And that's one of the reasons I'm in this position now teaching you this course. American Native Religion is a probably not taught in too many places. As any philosophy course, it'll probably be difficult to teach to
audio tapes and readings and so forth, but I'll do what I best. Let me point out to you that I am not in any way an expert in Native American religions or claim to be. I'm highly interested in the subject, and I know a number of students have voiced an interest in this subject, and this is one of the reasons it's being taught, besides my interest. And I've had, I guess when I say, some experience with American Native religion and thoughts. I was born and raised in Montana, and I worked and lived on the Blackfoot Reservation, Hill 57 in Great Falls. When I was young, I came to Alaska, and I went to Cape and was taken in and adopted by a Tlingit family, Tom and Mona Jackson of Cape, Alaska, and they are still my primary family. 13 kids, and I've lived a great many years down there, and have some feeling for some of the things I'm going to say in this course. Again, let me stress that a lot of the things I say are my thoughts, my feelings, and so don't take them as gospel truth, and don't feel that I'm trying to convince you that this is the way you should think. Please feel free to take issue with anything I say. If you'd like to argue with it, or if you'd like to add to it, or whatever. But please, the things I do say, take them in a, I guess not with a grain of salt, but take them as general information, or some things that, some ideas that I have, and I would like you to think about. And this is not necessarily if you have to agree with them or disagree with them. So, feel free to think as you want about some of the things I'm going to talk about. On this first tape, I'd like to talk a little bit about religion as a phenomena, Indian religion as a phenomena, and get into a little bit of sociology and anthropology, functions and role of religions in society. And I think this will give us somewhat of a background on how to approach some of the material we're going to be looking at. I'll get into some of the material specifically on the next tape when I deal with the assignments and stuff. That'll be the time for that. Perhaps, first of all, before we do that, I'd like to just quickly run through this course outline with you and make sure that everything's proper. I guess the course purposes are obvious, to introduce students to a wide variety of Native American religions. Basically, this information is going to come from Ruth Underhill's book, a very excellent survey of Native American religions. I'd like to have you think about Native American religions and how it is an integral part, an important part of Native American culture, both in the traditional sense and even today in the contemporary sense. And I guess by religion, I mean more than just religion per se. I mean a way of thinking, a way of looking at the supernatural, a way of looking at the world, as Elton Chung, so to speak. And one of the things I would like to deal with, as it says in course, is the differences and the contrast between Native American religion, Native American thinking, and white man's religion, and the difference and how they differently view the world. I'd like to take a look at this. I think it might be interesting. The readings, of course, as you can see, as you should have three books. First one is Red Man's Religion by Ruth Underhill. And as I said, it's an excellent survey of the book. It doesn't really go into any depth. Ruth Underhill is an anthropologist. Please read her introduction. But she's well thought of both by the scientific world, anthropologists, and she's highly thought of by the American Native communities that she's worked with. She's a very empathetic woman. This book reflects not a highly scientific point of view, but an objective and a subjective as well, empathetic point of view of a way of looking at Native American religion. Black Elk Speaks, the autobiography of a true holy man. Many of you may have read this. It's an excellent book, an excellent account of what true life was like, and it brings in very clearly how religion was related to the life, as Black Elk himself was a holy man, and this is his story. God is Red is a real interesting book by Vine DeLoria. He's the guy that wrote Custer Died for Your Sins. Very sarcastic, very biting, very radical, but very stimulating reading. Some of this reading of Vine DeLoria is kind of difficult. It's difficult for me. And I know many of you are freshmen, sophomores, so forth. And when we get to a couple of his chapters, I'll try to deal with him with you on tape. But in the meantime, if you get there before you get the tape, plug through it and see what you can get out of it. But I think you'll enjoy it, despite how difficult it is. He's really got some exciting ideas, and I think that the excitement of his ideas will overcome any difficulty you have in reading it. The other, we could have one article called Religion and Human Life by Robert Loy. An excellent article. But Robert Loy was another very fine anthropologist, very fine person who worked with American Indians for a great many years. And he has come around a long way. He was a kind of a disbeliever in religion and its function and so forth. And in his later days, he's had to stop and take a different look, at the role religion plays in society, and especially Native American societies. There'll be three assignments for the course, as it says there. The first assignment is you have five things I would like you to respond to. And I'll discuss on the second tape some of these issues. The readings are down below. There is quite a bit of reading, of course, but it's quite simple reading. I guess not simple, but it's quite easy reading, and it's good reading, and I think you'll enjoy it. This first assignment is due February 28th. This tape's going to be a little bit late, but I think if you get on it, you should be able to have it to me somewhere in the latter part of February. Well, that's all I'm going to talk about this course now, and I'll deal with the specific assignments individually on tapes as I go through them with you and as we go through the course. I guess one of the things I'd like to talk about first is what the nature of Indian religion, and I use the term Indian, I mean Native American religion, and let me just generalize and say Indian, but by Indian I mean Indian Eskimo Aleut people of the United States and Canada. But like American Indians as a whole, they've been greatly stereotyped over the years by movies, television, anthropologists. They've been judged by a standard that was set up of what they were like 100 years ago. This is how many Native American people are judged today and were judged 10, 15 years ago.
They're basically stereotyped as simple, primitive, outdoors, the noble savage, this Rousseauian type of classification. However, there's been some people that have been looking at these classifications and have raised issue with them. The first one, I guess, was Paul Radin, who wrote a book, Primitive Man as a Philosopher. And Radin began to show that indeed some of the philosophical thought and religious thought of these primitive people was extremely complex, extremely complicated, extremely sophisticated, and that it could not at all be classified as simple or primitive thought. Later in the last 10, 15 years, I guess, perhaps some of you have heard of the name of Claude Levi-Strauss, He's a Frenchman, and he's gone into the problem of mythology, thinking processes, and so forth of traditional people. And he has volumes and volumes of works out on the structure of primitive religion, mythology, and traditional thought, and so forth. So there has been work, and there is work in starting to look at traditional people's religions, and it's beginning to show that indeed they are not and cannot be classified as primitive or unsophisticated and whatever, that they are just as sophisticated, or perhaps more so, and with a different quality to them than contemporary Western religions. Religions, as you can see, Underhill talks about that there are a great many types of religions, ranging from some with very few simple ceremonies to things like the Catholic Church and the ceremonies they have here in this country and the Vatican City and whatever. And there's the whole spectrum in between. You know, like, for instance, even in the Catholic Church, you have a spectrum of the ceremony at the Vatican City and a ceremony in some little Mexican village or South American village down south. Very, very different, but all encompassed within the Catholic, as the Catholic Church. But despite all the differences in there, Underhill says that basically these religions have some common elements. And I think it's important that we run through these and give you some understanding of Native American religion. One of them is that most of them, they all have wonder-working objects. That is, some object like a fetish or an amulet or something that can work wonders. There is some power imbued in that object that it can do things. There's a relationship to animal and plant life. And this is among the Native American religions. This is, I guess, basically an apology to the animal world and the plant world for taking their lives. And there's usually some kind of thing set up to condone, to make up for the fact that they take these lives or take the plants from the earth, and they understand that, in a sense, that it's a gift, and they have to behave properly, and they apologize for taking it, and this makes it all right to do it again, so forth. Underhill's got a good chapter, and it deals with it in depth, and that's fear of women among Native American people, and this is an interesting thing. I would suggest, rather than going into any detail here, that you read that chapter. And of course, fear of death. Death is the unknown, the great unknown, the great discontinuity in society. Breaks up families, social structures. It's probably the biggest disruptive phenomena in any society. And then there's specialists. Another aspect that all these religions have, they have specialists to deal with the supernatural. Everybody can't deal with the supernatural in a society. They have to have specialists. We have ours, the Sioux have theirs, Tlingit have theirs, the Hopi have theirs. But these are people who have special knowledge or special gifts, or for whatever reason can deal with the religious nature better than the layman can. If I have time, I'll talk a little bit later about some of the affinities Native American religion has with other religions around the world. I was thinking specifically of Japanese religion and their relationship to nature, which is, I think, in many ways very similar to Native American thoughts on this subject. How did religions originate where'd they come from? I mean, were they handed down? But you know, somewhere along the line, they had to start. And I guess, anthropologically speaking, there are two great arguments on this issue. And I'll try to explain later that they really complement each other rather than they shouldn't be arguing against each other. Well, one of the theories put forth is by Bronislaw Malinowski, famous British anthropologist. And he says that traditional people, even us too for that matter, modern people, have a body of empirical knowledge of controlling nature. That is, that they know what they can do and they know what they can't do, like planting. They know how to, they can control nature to a certain limit. Put fertilizer in, water in, so forth. They don't have to wait for natural fertilizers. They apply this knowledge to get crops, fish, whatever. But one thing they can't do is they can't assure absolute success in these tasks. There's no certainty in the fishing. You know, the fish may leave the tide. They know the tides run, but certain things, you know, like maybe might be a red tide they hadn't counted on, or whatever. Certain things happen, and these give rise to anxiety, to worries about absolute success. And these anxieties and worries give rise, Malinowski says, for individuals to perform magical and religious rites, which indeed will ensure success. So he's saying that the individual, because he can't guarantee, he has a certain amount of knowledge of how to plant his crops, how to raise his crops, and so forth. But that knowledge does not guarantee the crops will come, because the rains have to come, not too much rain or not enough rain or whatever. So to ensure that happens, he has to go to the supernatural, and he performs certain ceremonies and tasks that guarantee the rains will come and the right amount of rain will come. Okay, he says this is the origin of religions. These anxieties of only being able to control nature up to a limit is what caused the rise of religion, individuals' anxieties. He differentiated, kind of a, I don't know how important this is, it just might be interesting to you. He differentiate between magic and religion. Basically, he says a magical rite has a magical ceremony has a definite purpose which is known to all who practices it. That is, you don't have to be a specialist to practice magic. Most people are, but many aren't. And for instance, things like wearing a good luck charm or this kind of thing tend to be magical in nature. There's certain definite actions that people take will cause a certain consequence. And this is what, and everyone knows these. You can ask anybody what certain magical acts are, and most people know. You know, you ask anybody what wearing a rabbit's foot will do, and they can tell you. Okay, he says religious rites are different. They're not clear, they're not definite like magic rites are. They're related to myths, and they function more underneath the surface. You know, like you go to church, you go to the Catholic Church, you go to any church. You know, the guy gets up there and goes through all kinds of rites and crosses himself and speaks in different languages. And, for instance, some of the ceremonies I go to, the church ceremonies in my region, is I don't really know what's ever going on until he gets to the ceremony and deals with some specific things. But it's certain rites that they're not clear to me. And he says this is the difference between magic and religion. Okay, the other idea about the origin of religion comes from Radcliffe Brown, another British anthropologist. And he says that it's not the individuals who have anxiety. He says, but certain occasions arise when society, when the group, expects man to be anxious. And when he becomes anxious, when the group expects for whatever happens, the group expects the man to perform a ceremony to alleviate the situation, So situations arise that the group feels men must be anxious about, worried about. So they should behave in an appropriate manner, namely some kind of ceremony to appease the situation, to deal with it. And this is so. It's appropriate, I guess, that individuals feel concern and carry out some symbolic ritual to express it. Yeah, society feels that individuals should express this concern through ritual, through religious expression, through magic, this kind of thing. So basically, I guess what the difference is that Malinowski says the individual feels anxiety on occasion, the individual does, and should have a ceremony to alleviate the anxiety. Radcliffe Brown says society expects the individual to feel anxious, to feel anxiety, and to have a ceremony. Obviously, we can see it both are true to a degree. It looks to me like they're just two sides of the same coin. Society is made up of individuals. Society is not made up of some strange thing that no one knows anything about. So, seems to me they both deal with the same thing. The functions of religion basically are related to the internal constitution of society. That is, it helps, it's weaved through society, it helps keep society together. It gives members of society confidence in dealing with everyday life, with dealing with being able to plant in the spring and hoping that the summer rains come, because they can have that ceremony in the spring and it relieves that anxiety. It gives the member confidence that indeed the rains will come because I performed the right ceremony or we have the right religion. It dispels these anxieties. It gets rid of them. It helps them live through. And it also strengthens the group as a whole. You know, if everyone's feeling good about it, you have these kind of ceremonies and you have to have community organization, community cooperation, society cooperation. That's important. Most of these religions, I think, would be fair to say that indeed they thought there was a direct connection between social organization and the nature of supernatural. So that when the social organization was out of whack, out of function, and the supernatural got out of whack, out of function, so people had reason to keep themselves straight, to set up a moral order, to behave themselves. And that way, if they behave right, the gods will behave right. And I think this is somewhat what they were thinking about. Well, what is a religious system? And what are its major components? We talked about some of the components, but I'd like to go a little bit beyond it. I'd like to give you a brief definition of what a religious system is. One thing, I guess, it's a sociologist definition, one that I've worked with for years. But I guess we could see it as a set of beliefs, a set of way of thinking about things, of beliefs, practices, and institutions which men have developed in response to aspects of life which they can't deal with, the supernatural and so forth, which aren't controllable. So men develop these things, these set of beliefs, practices, and these institutions, churches, clergy, and so forth, to deal with things they can't really handle in everyday life, and that's the supernatural. So religious system will include at the minimum a number of things, but here are five major components, namely a set of beliefs concerning things which means that are super, that related to the supernatural, something sacred, something set apart. Two, a system of symbols, objects, acts, persons, which have the quality of sacredness. They're expressive symbols. Three, they have definitely defined activities which are important, which have to be performed in relation to the beliefs up above. some group with a we feeling that see themselves as adhering to these values and to these ways of behaving and so forth, and in a sense that man's relation to the supernatural world is in some way related to his moral values, and this gives man the or makes man behave, because his moral behavior is related to the supernatural effects on him, to the God's behavior. Well, this tape is just about over, so I'll be talking a little bit more, but when it's over, I'll be done talking, and we'll go on tape two for your first assignment.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Schaefer again, your instructor for Humanities 294, Native American Religion. This is tape number two. And what I would like to do with this tape is talk a little bit about assignment number one, maybe discuss some of the ideas that you were supposed to, that you were supposed to deal with in answering these questions. I hope that each of you have your little course outline of how, not a course outline, a school pamphlet that should have been passed out to everybody by your field instructor and going over with your field instructor on how to deal with a course, how to do an assignment. So a lot of it's just mechanical side paper and this kind of thing, but some of it has to do with organization. And one of the things I would like you to do for this assignment, and I think it's important, I think it helps me, I think it helps you, when I write it helps me, and when I read it helps me, is use titles. For example, just take assignment A. Even if you just have to write a short paragraph or a long paragraph, title that paragraph, okay? Assignment 1, A. Okay, the paragraph states the main purpose of the ceremony in Indian religion. I can title that, whatever you want. Title it, for instance, Ceremony in Indian Religion, or Function of Ceremony in Indian Religion. Now, what's going to be the title? So if you're writing away, and you get, if there's anything or a guy in one way, you might get carried away, something you look like up there, and you say, what am I writing about? This doesn't have anything to do with the functions of ceremony. It's going to help remind you of what you should be dealing with in that assignment. Because these assignments are short, and it's going to be necessary that you deal explicitly with the subject at hand, and not bounce around with things that aren't really related to what you should be doing. Okay? Okay, well, let's go through some of these things. The first assignment, or the first take, if you remember, I talked about some functions of religion in human society, what it does, it keeps groups together, talked about some components of religion, just getting an idea of some structure of religion. And I hope that helped rather than confusion. I tried to talk to some general structures of religions worldwide, and in a little bit more specific structures of traditional religions, say, mainly religions in North America, Native people. Okay. Well, let's take a look at A from Losses. In the paragraph states on the main purpose of ceremony in Indian religion. Okay, well, basically, what is a ceremony? I guess that's the first thing we have to know. What is a ceremony? Okay, it is defined as a set of more or less prescribed activities, that is, definite activities, which are interpreted by the group, which are seen by the group as important and often obligatory or mandatory, so people perform these ceremonies. They're usually for special occasions. They're not directly related to everyday life. They just don't happen every time. A ceremony usually has a specific content, a specific function, a specific purpose. So when you're something doesn't pop up and say, hey, let's have a rain ceremony. There are reasons and times for it and specific things to do it. So they're special occasions. As I said before, ceremonies were the actual involvement of the group. A lot of laymen, often the ceremonies were conducted by specialists, but laymen were involved in a ceremony either as participants or as observers or whatever. And they were important to the laymen. But these ceremonies, remember, are based on myths, on stories, on some kind of structure that the layman knows very little about. Again, let me try to give you an example. Like the Catholic Church has a tremendous, complex, sophisticated myth of the Catholic Church from Peter in Rome, from the time of Christ up through the day. But the common everyday person goes to church, and he doesn't know anything about this myth. He doesn't know the particulars about it, but he attends a ceremony that is related to this myth, if you want to use that word. I like it. I think it's appropriate. So the layman, the common person, he's all involved in the ceremony on Sunday for an hour or so, but he's not really involved with the underlying or the overlying myth or structure that the ceremony basically deals with in theory. So the myth that these ceremonies are based on usually took secondary considerations, if they were even considered at all. The myths are usually vague and unimportant in relation to these ceremonies. Okay, the purpose of ceremonies is basically not worship. I think Underhill deals with this somewhat. In fact, before you do this, jump ahead in your readings with Underhill, and she's got a chapter on ceremonialism, and I think that might help you answer this a little bit. In her first two or three chapters, she talks about it, but also later on in the book, she talks about it. Take a look at her chapter on ceremonialism. But it's basically not worship, but it's a institutionalized, a specific set of behaviors where man renews his relationship with the supernatural, or man sets everything right again. For instance, a big ceremony that happens, I'm not sure exactly when it happened, they tried to have it at specific times, but oftentimes they couldn't because something would come up. But this was the Cheyenne Indians called the renewing of the arrows. They had sacred bundles. They call a sacred bundle. And in these bundles were a bunch of arrows and some other artifacts that were sacred to the Cheyenne people. And at a given time, the Northern Cheyenne and the Southern Cheyenne would meet, and they would have this ceremony where they would renew their life. They would renew their Cheyenne, all of the old, where they'd come in contact with white people or other Indians, something that made them a little less Cheyenne. All this would be eliminated by the ceremony, and they would be closer with their God, their religion, and they would, it was a renewing of a partnership with themselves and this broader, higher thing that they saw as being Cheyenne. Okay, some ceremonies are frequent. I mean, some societies have ceremonies all the time. Now, these ceremonies, they have a lot of ceremonies. But still, for the most part, they're at specific times. They were not just held haphazardly. And these ceremonies are very important part, play a very important part in the social life of groups. That is, they were more than just the renewing of certain aspects of supernatural to the group or the tribe. They played a very important social function. They helped. They were cause for feasting, for dancing, marriages, lovemaking, this whole thing. A very, often very exciting time for groups. The ceremonies have changed over the years for a great part. Originally, and even today, there are still some. These ceremonies were performed to appease or to satisfy or please the gods or the spirits that ceremony was directed to. For instance, the rain ceremony. The people went through the rain ceremony to please that rain god. They were not directed at the human audience. When these people went through the ceremony, they really didn't care whether there were 200 people watching them or no people watching them. That the purpose of that ceremony was to please the god. Traditionally, I think Underhill deals with this,
She says that the emphasis was on a pure mind, having a pure mind, dealing with the people who were involved in the ceremony, dealing with the supernatural, and the emphasis was on the idea to be conveyed. And colorful costumes, and the beauty of specific motions and so forth, these are later inventions, and she attributes them basically to acculturation process, the coming in of European groups, and the colors, the beads, and so forth. She says that it is these groups that have introduced color, and whereas performance to the audience started taking on importance. Dances were often sacred religious ceremonies. In fact, in a great many of these, probably most of them, I would say, with Native American people, is that most of these ceremonies were accompanied by dances. Okay, let me give you, I'm talking about that the emphasis has changed, that traditionally that it was basically the idea, purity of mind, and the idea to be conveyed is what was important, and not necessarily color and movement and this kind of thing. Let me give you an example of this that strikes close home to me, and this is among the Tlingit, and some of the comments I've heard the old people say at home, and my mother and dad said at home. Okay, many of you may have seen the Tlingit dancers that come up from, there's some in Ketchikan, I think, and the ones from Haines and so forth, and they have these elaborate dances, very beautiful costumes, and they go through these very elaborate motions of various activities, the slaying of the bear and the monsters that chase the people around, and they enact out a very various rituals and myths that are important to the Tlingit people. But the old people say that this isn't how they did it in the old days. They said that these ceremonies were held to please, if it was a dance about a bear or something, the ceremony, the dance was held to please the bear, not to please 50 people sitting out there watching it. And so that the motions were not elaborate and stuff, and that the dancing was very different from where it is today, that all these elaborate motions were not gone through, that they were symbolized by slight motions, that you didn't have to take a spear and raise it and the person fall down the ground, you put the spear to their throat and two or three people drag that other person off. This is the way it's done today, and it's very interesting and it's very exciting the way it's done today, but it has changed, the old people say. That years ago this wasn't done this way, that just slight movements by hand and body were enough to symbolize this whole process of the attack and the spear and carried off and so forth. Because the animal knew, the people who were, or the gods, or the supernatural force that was observing this ritual, knew what these people were trying to convey. They didn't. They knew by the purity of the mind, by the intensity of the idea, by the devoutness of the person going through these ceremonies. They didn't have to see all these motions. These, and this has changed because a lot of these things now have become more and more public. And this isn't among the Tlingit. This is among the Hopi, the Navajo, the Sioux. Have you ever seen pictures of the old ghost dance where they lined up for and they dance very quietly, just barely moving their feet? Have you ever been to a modern Indian powwow now? Some of the dances they do, they're for the audience, and they just go wild, very exciting, very fun to participate in, but it's not the same as it was. Perhaps now much of the dance has gone out of the realm of ceremony. I guess I don't want you to think that I'm trying to say that dances are ceremonies now. Maybe dances are dances now, but they used to be an important part of ceremony, and they've changed their function. In the second In B, assignment 1B, how does that read? It says, in one or two paragraphs, discuss what Underhill meant when she says that there are two levels of religious understanding in any group. Okay, why is this important? Well, I think it's something we all have to deal with. And I think it refers to the clergy and the layman. And I hope, I'm interested to see what your thoughts are on this. But basically what Underhill says is that there are two levels of religious understanding in any group. The thinkers and, for lack of better words, the non-thinkers. And the thinkers, I think she's talking about people who are concerned about the religious structure, the effects, the specialists, the spiritual leaders. These are the thinkers. And then the non-thinkers are the doers, the people that go through the ceremony, participate, but they're not really concerned about these broader issues. They're more concerned about getting out hunting or harvesting. They're the layman, perhaps like you and me. You know, when we go to church, it's the guys up front that are the thinkers about what's happening. Okay, I think this is one of the things he's talking about. Anyway, I'm interested to see you discuss in a couple of paragraphs what you see as the two levels of religious understanding in any group. And for this assignment also, for this one, I'd like you to read Lloyd's article. You have to read it for this chapter, or for this assignment anyway. But read his, and he talks about the same thing, about the different people in the different levels of thinkers in religious groups. And I think that some of his information will help you write this out. So take a look at Lloyd and see what happens. The concept of personal power, this is C, assignment 1. I think has always been important in Native American religions. It has been in a lot of religions, but especially Native American religions, and especially those religions, or especially in religion, in those groups that individualism was important. Say, for instance, among the Plains Indians, they were war-oriented and so forth. People who could demonstrate certain aspects of personal power, that they have it, often took various leadership roles within these groups. So this is one of the reasons it was important. Or if it wasn't necessarily a leadership role, it was a different role if they could demonstrate that they have personal power. People looked upon them with respect or awe or fear or whatever. Women, of course, had very special power. And this gave them, and that power, of course, of birth and the mystery of birth. This is something that men could not do, is give birth. And this gave women a power. Fear of women, Underhill talks about it, is widespread in the world. I guess one of the interesting things about the fear of women is that it changes. It seems to be that up north, women are more feared than they are down south. That is, among the Athabascans and the Canadian tribes, the Ojibwa, and so forth, the people had a great fear of women. And when they reached, when they started their menstruation, sometimes they had to go into seclusion for 2 or 3 years at a time. But the further south you go, this time became less and less, whereas when you get way down south in Arizona stuff, it was a symbolic 1 or 2 day type of thing. But there was read that chapter in Underhill about women. I think you find it extremely interesting. Personal power obviously differs from impersonal power, and Underhill talks about impersonal power, that is magic that can be manipulated by forces of rule. That is, there are certain rules that can cause certain things to happen, no matter who does the rule. You don't have to be a priest to do it or something. This is an impersonal power. Fetishes, amulets, good luck charms, this kind of thing, are impersonal. They're important and impersonal. As you can share your luck, you can have a real lucky thing and you give it to someone else if you will him that good luck. He can use your luck and use your good luck charm and have success with it. Animism is an important part of Native American religion and an important impersonal power. Basically, what this refers to is that things have spirits. All things, rocks, trees, mountains, places, animals, whatever. And these spirits vary and stuff. But all things have an aura, some kind of essence about them that has to be taken into consideration when you deal with them. A place where this is carried out probably to the most extreme is in Japan, religion called Shintoism. And there, anything that is exceptional, that is exceptionally beautiful, exceptionally odd-shaped, or whatever, given some kind of recognition as having a power that emanates from it. For instance, a very beautiful tree, an old gnarled tree or whatever, there's these thousands and thousands, perhaps even millions, of little Shinto shrines all over Japan. So you're walking down these little roads and all of a sudden here'd be this little Shinto shrine. Right behind it would be this beautiful or this rustic rock sticking out or this old tree or a spot. And there'd be a little shrine there commemorating the spirit of this rock. You know, why is it here? Obviously it's there for a reason. Its spirit wanted to be seen and it should be worshipped, or should be not necessarily worshipped, but it should be recognized. And these little shrines in Japan recognize this these things, these natural things that have these powers. A lot of shrines to animals, foxes, deers, birds, this kind of thing, same way. Okay, this is animism, and this is a thing in American Indian religions that was very, very important. Okay, question D, or statement D, it says, in one or two paragraph statement, discuss one major role or function of religion among the Sioux people as illustrated in Black Elk Speak. Okay, well, Black Elk, the first chapter, of course, and a number of other chapters, his vision chapter, the great vision, there's a lot there where he talks about how religion functions among the Sioux, what role it plays among the Sioux. Now, what I'd like you to do is discuss one major role in religion that you can find in Black Elk Speak. Now, a lot of the stuff he talks about, he doesn't say the function of religion is. He talks about it very abstractly, and you kind of have to dig around in it. You have to think, now, how is religion related to some of the things he's talking about? For instance, the chapter on the vision of what importance is religion? How does this function in their society? So it's kind of a think. This time it's kind of a thinking one on your part, because he doesn't. It's not detailed. The roles of functions of religion are not detailed in his narrative. You have to infer what some of these functions of religion are. I would be sure and read the other readings for this assignment too. Be sure you've read Loy. Be sure you've read Underhill. I think these are going to help you a lot in this with this assignment. Again, you know, these have titles. Don't forget your title on this. You know, you might just title this one something similar to the function of religion in Sioux society, as illustrated by Black Elk Speaks, and then do your two couple paragraphs discussing the function of religion in Sioux society. Okay, lastly, the last one is I'm asking you to say write about what do you think Robert Loy was trying to say about the role of religion in human society. And I told you about this article a little bit. Loy deals with a number of things, the place of religion in society, what it does, how it functions. He also deals with the question of religion and science. A lot of people think that they're opposed to each other, and this is not necessarily the case. I think he does a good job of dealing with this. But he has got some things to say about religion. And in a paragraph or two, I'd like you to summarize what he's saying. And perhaps, well, a great part of his paper deals with Native American religion, because he did a lot of field work among them. So he talks specifically about some Indian groups, the Crow, I think, and the Hopi. And then you've read Underhill, and you've read about the Sioux. So, refer to this information as well. Just don't use Loy's idea. And when I say, what do you think Loy is trying to say about the role of religion in human society, let's try to narrow it down to Native American society. What is the role of religion in Native American society? Using Loy's ideas, Loy's feelings about it. I think this might make for some interesting exercises on your part to come up with some ideas. Okay, again, there are a lot of these things. What do you think Loy was trying to say? And that's exactly what I mean. I hope to learn a lot from your assignments. Because a lot of these things, there are no right or wrong answers. They're just your thoughts, and it's how deep and how deep you penetrate into the problem is going to determine the quality of your paper. So I'd be real surprised if I didn't learn anything from these. I'm expecting to get a lot of new information, a lot of new ideas, things that I haven't thought about from these students. So I'm really looking forward to this. So feel free to express your own ideas.
Saturday evening for me, and some last night on the day. Beautiful, really. Is it close to Fort Yukon, and it's been beautiful all year long? Is it been the same for you already? I can't believe it. I got snow there for about 4 hours this morning. It's magnificent. No time to worry. Got one rabbit over here, but no time to worry. Maybe I didn't do the right thing.